Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Aaron Conley, and I'm the director of the Southeast Asia Project here at the Institute. Let me start by acknowledging this event is being held on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and to pay respects to their elders, past and present, and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander peoples who are in the audience today. And let me thank you for joining us for this panel on Malaysia's most recent general election, which will be also be broadcast on the Lowy Institute's podcast channel and The Big Idea on Radio National. The defeat of Malaysia's ruling coalition, Barisan Nasional, 4 weeks ago today, was unlike any election result the region has ever seen. No party in Southeast Asia has held power for so long, only to lose it at the polls. In its place, a broad coalition led by 92-year-old former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has formed a new government. Our panel today will discuss these developments, why they happened, and most importantly, what comes next. And then we'll go to you for your questions and to continue the discussion. But first, let me introduce our panelists. To my left, Dr. Amrita Malhi is visiting fellow in the Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the ANU. She is a historian with an interest in the histories and politics of Muslim movements in Southeast Asia, especially in Malaysia. Professor James Chin is the director of the Asia Institute Tasmania at the University of Tasmania. He is an expert on governance issues in Southeast Asia, especially in Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore, and one of the world's most well-regarded experts on Malaysian elections. Keen Wong is a Malaysian journalist and contributing editor at New Mandala, where he has been covering the Malaysian elections since the beginning of the year, when many others thought that they were going to be, quote-unquote, boring. Mm-hmm. Mr. Wong has had a long career in journalism and previously worked at the BBC, the ABC, and The Economist, among others. He's published in academic journals on freedom of the press in Asia. Just a note on nomenclature. I have had some difficulty getting used to the idea of referring to Pakatan Harapan as the government. I keep calling them the opposition, so we'll be tried to be very clear on nomenclature when we talk about the opposition. We're talking about Barisan Nasional. When we're talking about the government, we're talking about the new government, Pakatan Harapan. And so let me start with you, Amrita, and ask you to put this in perspective. Help us understand the context for what has happened and just what a big deal this is in Malaysia.
Yeah, well, thanks, Aaron, and thanks for having me. Look, it's a really big deal. I think, you know, given that we've witnessed a nation that's had the same government since independence actually deliver a change of government at the ballot box, I think is, just phenomenal. I mean, the fact that a system, an electoral system that was ultimately designed to limit competition with Barisan Nasional was able to be overwhelmed. So the ways in which it worked to limit that competition were unable to keep up with the opposition surge or the surge towards the new government, as we're now trying to be careful to say. And so in that context, I guess, you know, people have talked about the gerrymandering and the malapportionment in the system for a long time. For voters to be able to overcome those obstacles, I think, has been really quite remarkable. And so in the end, what we saw was this quite artful, exceptional mobilization of a whole lot of different factors that have been building up over a long time, so decades really. So things like rising inequality, corruption, of course, which was unable to hide and unable to, you know, impossible to defend. The use of technology. We saw, you know, basically the new government mobilize a whole lot of different social and economic and political changes. They also mobilized regional geopolitics. So they talked about China, as I think we'll probably go into later. They also talked about, the GST, wages, prices, all these things that speak to inequality. They talked about the potential loss of sovereignty. So they spoke to social and national memory. And really, they put all these things together in a way that was so masterful that it was actually able to mobilize voters to that extent to get over the obstacles in the electoral system.
And James, perhaps you can tell us, where did UMNO, where did Barisan Nasional, and where did Najib Razak, where did they go wrong? How did they lose this election, given the barriers to that Amrita has described?
Sure. I think one of the problems with studying Malaysian elections is that very often you look at the big picture, you keep forgetting that the way the system is structured, the people who decide the outcomes of election is basically the Malay community, not the entire Malaysian community. And I think what you saw in this election was that the Malay community itself was split. And because the Chinese and the Indian and the other minorities were solidly for the opposition. Once the Malay community was split, that was enough for the opposition to overcome the barrier. But I think one of the key issues that we have to ask ourselves is that how come so many people got it wrong? And I've been thinking about this for quite some time, and I think basically the answer comes down to this. One of the reasons why a lot of people got it wrong was because all the polling before May the 9th showed that the Barisan, at the very least, will win with a very slight majority, somewhere between 5 to 10 seats. What I suspect happened was that since the last election, 2013, people have already sort of gotten very angry with Najib. And the reason why they got very angry with Najib was because of the 1MDB corruption issue. But being Malaysians, like most of Southeast Asia, they kept political views to themselves. So Malaysians are very funny people. When you ask them a sensitive issue like your health or politics, they tend to hide it or they don't tell the truth. So when you do your surveys, because they think that Barisan is such a strong government, they will win again. So there's no need for me to offend the government. So I'll just say I support the Barisan. So that's one explanation. In other words, people already made up the line basically after 2013. Because as you remember, right, one of the key elements of the 2013 election was that the opposition won the popular vote. And big chunks of Malaysians were very angry that the popular vote did not mean a change of government because of the first-past-the-post system. So people are very angry, plus all these corruption allegations against Najib. So the Najib brand itself became toxic. So if you know Malaysia, right, you can't separate the brand of the political leader and the party. So when the Najib brand became toxic, UMNO's brand, the ruling party's brand, also became toxic. Now, Najib tried very, very hard to rehabilitate his brand, but he couldn't do it for two reasons. One was because the wife was also very toxic.
Najib's wife.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very obvious. And within the conservative Malay population, the behavior of his family also became very toxic. So, for example, the stepson was involved in the movie, which can't be shown in Malaysia, as you all know, that sort of thing. So the brand itself was very toxic from 2013 onwards. So this sort of built up the momentum until we sort of reached a tipping point. The other explanation is that there was a large last-minute swing among the Malay ground for the opposition. And the reason I said that was because I was in Malaysia and noticed that towards the end, right, although a lot of people said that they support the Barisan, when you start talking to them in depth, you realize that they support the Barisan, but on that day, they will vote against the Barisan. So the idea was that it was a very strong anti-Najib vote. They just wanted Najib out of power. So I think two things. One, the toxic brand was slowly brewing up, plus there was a last-minute swing. And I saw this very, very clearly the night before the election when both leaders, Najib and Mahathir, gave a speech. Najib appeared on the state-run television, and Mahathir, despite the fact that he's 92 or 93 years old, he appeared on Facebook Live. And if you were to watch the two speeches, right, it was very clear. One was appealing to Malay dignity, you know, we have to do something about towering Malays. We have to make sure that the Malays come back. We do not want the Malays to be associated with kleptocracy, corruption, or that sort of thing. The other guy gave a speech that was quite unusual. It was like a very transactional speech.
Najib's speech.
Yes. He was saying things like, you know, if you vote for me, if you're under 26 years old, you get a tax break, free tax holiday. If you know, if you support me, you get holidays, additional high raya holiday, all that sort of thing. So it was very transactional. So you can see for the bulk of the Malay population, as I mentioned, they are the one who decide the outcome. You can see the Malay population was already split. And I think the clincher was the speech the night before.
King, you were on the ground in Johor for much of the election and in the Malay heartlands. Was that what you saw? Was it turning on this question of dignity? Some people have said that Mahathir offered Malay voters dignity while Najib offered them a deal. Was that the deal that they rejected? Did they go for dignity over the deal?
I think very much so, in that going across the country during the elections, but even before that, I think that there has been a long-standing, perhaps couple of years, worth of yearning for change. The question is, what sort of change was available? And also, was that change able to address a deep-seated anxiety that was helpfully ventilated by the government-linked media over anxiety over Malay culture, Malay dignity, the primacy of a particular Islamist agenda, but not a monolithic Islamist agenda. It was quite fractured. And a lot of that, I think, came down to, you know, speaking to villagers or semi-urban small town people. I actually had this newfound respect, actually, for Malaysians who I thought were amazingly clever in terms of wanting to see how to vote tactically. And I think that came through in the end. They resented and hated the so-called toxic Najib to the extent, I wrote about this, free plug, check out New Mandala, it's all there. I wrote about this at the time, and basically that even the UMNO party operatives were campaigning and saying, look, we want to play politics as local as possible. Because if we played it national, even statewide, we've got this toxic leader, toxic leadership. We just can't deal with it. We have to win in our home base. And we've got to keep the issues local to the extent, you know, was it dam water? Is it council collections? You know, that sort of stuff. And so they weren't into the vision thing that Najib was propagating. So it became like this strange cross-purposes of politics. And I think the other thing that was a game changer was Mahathir. In the last week, the reassurance that this Malay anxiety was addressed was, I think it was about the last or third last day, when basically you could say the old dream team got together again on stage in Malacca, in the state of Malacca, where basically you had Daim Zainuddin, the ex-finance minister, the well-known trade minister, Rafida Aziz, Mahathir, a whole bunch of them were all on stage together. And it's sort of like, you know, they got the band back together again. And everyone thought, great, we could trust these guys. They'd play the greatest hits, you know, and we could, you know, we can deal with this. And that really, I think, drove home Mahathir's own type of campaigning, which, to recall, I think it was Mario Cuomo who said, you know, he was campaigning in poetry, but now we've got this governing in prose problem. But he was really cutting through with this type of personal enmity message, which Anwar, having covered the previous elections where they won the popular vote in 2013, Anwar could never close the deal. And Mahathir did by creating this, you know, facsimile or paper cutout of Najib and kept closing the deal with just two simple words all the time, always on message. One was Puncturi, thief. The other one was Penyangka, this type of terrible accusation of, a conspiratorial type of thief. And he just kept saying that. That was it. There was none of this appeal to philosophy that Anwar can tend to go on with.
Amrita, I want to ask you, because Mahathir clearly played a big role in the election, and many will say that the opposition, former opposition, could not have won without him. But he leads a party that only has 13 members. Two of his coalition members, coalition parties, have numbers in the 40s. How powerful will Mahathir be vis-a-vis these other parties, the Democratic Action Party and PKR, Anwar Ibrahim's party?
Well, I think the answer to that is pretty powerful. And I think the reason for that is because of what he was able to do. So for one, as James mentioned, he was able to split the Malay Muslim voting bloc that Najib, UMNO and Barisan have relied on just for ages now, especially since 2008. They've actually been relying on that bloc more and more and more. So Barisan National, despite being a national front, that's what Barisan National means, has been whittling away its core support in terms of minorities, etc., to the point now where they've, you know, they've really been relying on those seats in the rural areas that have been exceptionally powerful because of the electoral system. And so Mahathir was able to come in and actually break that block right down the middle, or perhaps we haven't measured if it really is right down the middle, but he was able to break it in, you know, break it apart and mobilize it. And that's where I think his value is, and that's where his power comes from, is he's able to say to these people, not only that we will restore your dignity, but also that we'll restore your sovereignty. And I think actually there was a philosophical angle to it all, and that angle was ultimately that appeal to the risk that Malay Muslims face under Najib, or so he put it anyway, the risk that they would be mortgaged, that they would be hocked because of 1MDB, because of the debt, and because of Najib's need to go around finding money to bail out the debt, and therefore the Chinese projects that were being set up in a basically in a ring around the Malay Peninsula. He was able to point to them and say, listen, everyone, your sovereignty is at risk, and that sovereignty, that risk is actually brought to you directly by your own prime minister, your own government, the one that says it's going to defend you and defend your special rights as Malays and Muslims, is in fact selling you to China. And opposition messaging referred to this just all over the place, and it was very carefully done, and it was, I think, you know, this perfect combination of, you know, you spot an opportunity, so a bit of opportunism there on the one hand, but also some art. And so they were able to, for example, use the China threat that they deployed against what Barisan was saying about them. So Barisan used to always be able to develop these very scary moral panics about, you know, if you vote for the opposition, now the government, if you vote for Pakatan Harapan, ultimately you're going to bring the DAP, the very Chinese DAP, Democratic Action Party, to power. And what you're going to then deliver is a loss of sovereignty, because the Chinese are going to come to power in Malaysia and they're going to take your sovereignty away. Mahathir was able to say, no, it's not these Chinese, it's not your friends and neighbours, it's those Chinese, it's the People's Republic, and it's your prime minister who is about to sell the nation to them. And so there was a very strong point made, not just about local dignity, I think, but about dignity on the world stage, dignity as a sovereign people. And so that, I think that's where Mahathir derives a lot of his power, actually.
I want to come back to this issue of the two Chinas that you've written on. But first, maybe we can turn to the challenges of the new government, because as Keane says, they now have to govern in prose. James, can you tell us what are the main challenges facing the new government?
Sure. I think they have a big plate in front of them, which they have to resolve a lot of the key issues. But I think one of the things I was quite disappointed was that there were two key issues facing Malaysia that were not addressed in the general elections. And I think these are the two crucial issues as we go forward. The first is political Islam in Malaysia. I think this is a very, very serious issue. Most people do not realize that there's actually a large section of the Malay youth in Malaysia who do not study in the government system. They go to private tafiz school. And even the government itself do not know what is the actual number. I actually went to the Islamic authorities in Kuala Lumpur and asked them how many students are studying in this school. They could only give me an estimate. The reason why this group is extremely, I do not want to use the word dangerous, but politically sensitive in Malaysia is that very often, these tafiz schools are founded by individual Muslim clerics, and the curriculum they use is totally alien to Malaysia. So basically, if the guy was trained in Pakistan, he'll bring back the Pakistan curriculum. If he's gone to Jordan, he'll bring back the Jordanese curriculum. Whatever it is, the basic point is this. You've got people entering this tafiz school at a very young age. We're talking about something between 6 and 7 years old. By the time they come out of the system, they're 16 or 17 years old. So during the entire formative period, they have basically no connections with Malaysia because the curriculum is foreign. Secondly, they have no experience of dealing with the non-Muslim population. And whether you like it or not, more than 30% of Malaysia's population is non-Muslim. So this group comes out and immediately they're very alien to the environment. The only commonality among this group of people is that they all want to set up an Islamic State in Malaysia. The problem is that they can't agree what sort of Islamic State they want to set up in Malaysia, and they can't agree on what to do with the current governing structure. But nevertheless, they are agitating in the background. And in the last few years, especially the group from the Salafi side, they have penetrated quite deeply in UMNO politics and also in PAS politics. So this group will be very politically quite dangerous for Malaysia's future. The other big issue that wasn't addressed in this election, which I think is also crucial to Malaysia's future, is what we call in Malaysia the Bumiputera policy. Now in Malaysia, they call it the Malay agenda. This is a crucial issue in Malaysia because a lot of the problems in Malaysia, especially on the economic side, is linked to this Malay agenda. One of the problems...
You can just give us a little bit of a sense of what that entails.
Right. Malay Agenda is simply the affirmative action policy that was established in 1971. The idea was to help the Malay community because they were very far behind the Chinese and the Indians. And in Malaysia, the way it works is that the government has set up a quota system across all areas, not only in the economy, but also in education, social space, business opportunities. The idea was to help the Malay community catch up with the other communities. But the problem is that after they start implementing it from a couple of years, the Malay agenda became Ketuanan Melayu, Malay supremacy. So what happened was that rather than the system trying to correct the imbalance in the community, it created this thing called Malay supremacy, where the Malays dominate the system to such an extent that all the minority groups in Malaysia do not have a place in the political arena. This issue is linked to the economy, linked to religion, linked to everything. And if you don't deal with this issue, Malaysia can never be a normal country. So the bottom line is this is linked, especially in the area economy, because of the Malay agenda, you'll find that the Malaysia's economy is lagging behind regionally.
King, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the divisions within the new government on these questions. This is a really broad coalition. It seems as though the only thing they really agreed on was getting rid of Najib. What are the different views on these two issues, the education system and on political Islam?
I think the thing that we could at least be cautiously optimistic about, given that it's not quite 1 month, but I think they're making a lot of the right steps in terms of trying to do institutional reform and recasting of this. That council of eminent people trying to work out where to go next in terms of the economic model, the institutional reforms committee that they're trying to also push through, the Home Minister is making all the right noises about trying to repeal a lot of the oppressive laws that are in place. At the same time, I think we have, good reason to at least take it at face value that they're going to tackle precisely this Ketuanan Melayu Islamist thing that you're talking about, James. I know James is more skeptical than I am about this, but I think civil society organizations that have been trying to work out this non-racialized narrative that Amrita and I have actually previously discussed this, are actually not going to go back into their shells anytime soon. And in fact, if anything, the conversation that's going on now is that they feel that it's very important to defend this sort of liberal rules-based order that maybe is in askance elsewhere. But, people like that idea in Malaysia and trying to make a nation of it now. And they want to try and galvanize the government to fulfill that manifesto, in which a lot of this non-racialized, non-Islamic necessarily agenda is actually revised. However, there is this cautionary advice from people like Anwar Ibrahim that, don't push too far too soon and basically take it on faith that, they're going to carry it out.
Amrita, how is UMNO, United Malays National Organization, formerly in government for decades, now in opposition, how are they handling the shock of this defeat? And what has been their response to the prospect of policy change when it comes to some of these racial preferences for Bumiputras, which arguably that is the entire raison d'etre of this party?
Well, I don't know if they're handling it all that well. I think that there is every indication that they don't actually know which way to go just yet. There are discussions about, should we attempt to be an effective opposition? I would like to know what effective means. Does that mean stopping everything from happening, or does it mean, being a kind of a loyal opposition where you basically just be a check and a balance, but ultimately you're, in line with a kind of a broader national agenda? So I don't really know where they're going to go, and initial inquiries are not yielding any great answers because I think they've got to think about it first themselves. There are all kinds of things being hinted. So there are particular UMNO leaders saying things like, maybe we should group up with BAS, the opposition Islamist party, still in the opposition. And right now there's a whole lot of, aside from UMNO, there's a massive Islamist lobby that's grown up over the last couple of decades that is now sort of cast adrift from the national government. So there's going to be people out and about looking for new patrons. looking for new arguments that they might be able to make. Already there's been some mobilization against Tommy Thomas and his appointment as Attorney General, for example.
Why don't we just bring that into specific relief, because that has been the big controversial issue in Malaysia this week, the appointment of a non-Muslim Attorney General.
Yeah.
What has been the debate about his appointment, and how has the civil service responded to that in particular, and the royals?
Well, the debate has been about what sort of nation and what sort of state Malaysia should be, and therefore what sort of Attorney General it should have. And so if there is a non-Malay, non-Muslim Attorney General, does that mean that the question about the nation and what sort of state it should have is now resolved in favour of the idea of the secular state that is there in the Constitution? So the Constitution has a bit of a contradiction in it, I suppose, is one way of looking at it, in that Malaysia is meant to be a secular state, but Islam is the official religion. So how do you reconcile these two things? Well, that's been a matter of debate for a long, long time. And certainly the Islamist lobby would like it to be reconciled in terms of Malaysia officially and formally becoming an Islamic state, however that might be defined, and there's some debate about how to define that. But then if a non-Muslim, non-Malay is appointed as the Attorney General, then does that mean that that battle is lost? Does that mean that the new government is trying to send certain kinds of signals? Presumably it is trying to send certain kinds of signals, that it is now the government and it appoints officials and it has a policy agenda. At the same time, that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be some pushback against that agenda. And I think we've seen how that pushback can be expressed.
James, I'm curious, do you see the fact that the king, the Agong, appointed Tommy Thomas as Attorney General after reportedly some initial resistance to that idea and a delay, do you see that as a sign that the system actually is getting on with some with this new approach to policy, a new approach to race relations in Malaysia?
No. sorry, I have to be very blunt. I have a reputation for being blunt. Anyway, I need to say something about UMNO. I think a lot of people, especially in the West, are misreading the situation. If you really want to understand what's happening with UMNO, you need to read the Malay language blogs. And if you read the Malay language blogs now, what is very clear coming out is that UMNO is not in chaos. In fact, the leadership of UMNO is actually quite united. The fight is over who's going to be the next president and vice president of UMNO. It is not about where UMNO is going. And I'll tell you the reasons why. If you look at the electoral system as a whole, right? There's roughly about 110 to 120 Malay majority seats. Bersatu, Mahathir's party, only won about 10% of the seats. So 80 to 90% of Malay seats is still held by UMNO and PAS. So UMNO is still the preferred party for the Malay community, even though in terms of popular votes, they account for about 60%. So within UMNO itself, the debate is not about whether they're going to be a strong opposition or whatever it is. It is how to recover the ground in order to capture power. Right now, a lot of people in UMNO, including the so-called intellectuals in UMNO, are making the argument that we shouldn't worry too much. In fact, the defeat of UMNO is a blessing in disguise. Because for a very long time, there was a group of people in UMNO, bedroom boys, who always regard UMNO as something very similar to the LDP in Japan. In other words, if we can get our power for a while, this allows us to reform and we'll come back into power very quickly. So for them, right, important thing is that we lock onto the Malay votes. We have to find a way to work with PAS. It may be we move to the right and join up with PAS, but whatever it is, this reforms agenda allow us to bring new leadership in. And this is consistent with what I said earlier. UMNO party itself has come to realize, if you read all the statements coming out from the leaders, the problem in this election is not UMNO per se, it was the toxic brand of Najib. So if you look at all the leadership, including Zahid himself, he has come up openly. He gave a very important...
Zahid being the former deputy president.
And Hisham Mudin, the other front runner UMNO, they all gave important interviews in the Malay language where they blame Najib. They said all this is due to Najib and the 1MDB crisis. They never blame the party as a whole.
How quickly your friends desert you when you lose an election. I'm curious, Keen, Pakatan Harapan, this new governing coalition, do you think that it can stick together? And this is such a broad coalition. You have Warisan from Sabah, a Sabahan party. You have Amana, an Islamist party. You have the DAP, majority Chinese party. You have PKR, ostensibly a liberal party, and then, of course, Mahathir Bersatu. It's very broad. Can they actually cooperate, or do you see one of them defecting to try and work with the opposition?
I think the really fascinating thing about this is, you know, speaking off James's point as well, is that so much is up for grabs right now, and so much of this articulation of what Malaysia can or should be is in contest. And Pakatan itself, you know, has this very broad vision, it's all in the manifesto, about trying to do some non-racialized modern economy that in a way gets rid of this type of neo-feudal relationship where, for instance, over half the economy is somehow or another linked to the government and government-linked corporations. I think Pakatan itself, you know, going forward, will rely a lot on political leadership to actually say, we want to achieve these things and this is how we're going to achieve it, and to actually articulate that. And similarly, I think with the UMNO PAS so-called coalition that people are warning about, I just don't think that's actually going to happen. I don't want to make any bets about this, but I just don't think it's going to happen given the fractures within PAS itself are very deep. There's about three camps in there, and some of it was reflected in a strange way by their return to power holding two states, Kelantan and Terengganu, which had to do with actually both a vote against UMNO, and because PKR is not very strong, the opposition is not very strong on the East Coast, and also a vote against the current leadership of Hadi Awang of PAS, because he was not running. So the various schools of Islamist politics, I think, are themselves trying to contend with how to hold on to and win power, partly in the discussion, Malay discussion groups that James refers to. They talk about, you know, learning from the Morsi experience in Egypt and how that was bundled out so quickly as well. And how far do you push?
Mm. I think it's time to open it up to questions. I hope you have a few ready.
Okay, it's Rob Coombe. Maybe a question for James. Just interested in the Malay agenda point that you touched on before, and really try and get a perspective from you as to whether there is really going to be any meaningful reform to it when you consider that you've got Mahathir in as Prime Minister at the moment. He was the architect of most of that, wrote the Malay Dilemma and so on, had plenty of opportunity to sunset it, never did. And then you've got the opposition, which, as you said, has the support of the Malays. It's not really fertile ground for that agenda to be reformed, I wouldn't have thought, but be really interested in your view.
Sure, I think you've answered the question yourself. I think for the short term, while Mahathir is Prime Minister, I think the only reform they'll make will be among the Bumiputera community itself. So, for example, under this new finance minister, Lim Guang Eng, what he's going to introduce is there will still be quota for so-called Bumiputera tenders only. So there will still be businesses, government procurement locking for the Bumiputera. But rather than direct negotiation, which they've done previously, they will ask the Bumiputera vendors to compete among themselves. So this will cut back on what we call the rank-seeking behavior. So previously, and you can check this very easily, highways in Malaysia are extremely expensive. You can do a cost comparison by looking at World Bank figures. So typically, in the good old days, you can double the price of anything in Malaysia for government projects. So going forward is an improvement because now you can maybe mark up 20 or 30%. So no big changes in Bumiputera policy, but there'll be more competition within the Bumiputera community itself.
Yes, Richard McGregor in the front row here.
Yes, a question to any of you. Is Dr. Mahathir or his government genuinely interested in a reset of relations with China, or does he simply want to renegotiate a better price for various projects? I mean, give me a sense of how real a possible change in that relationship is.
Amrita?
Well, I think it depends on what sort of change you're looking for. I mean, I think if there's a narrative developing that, you know, perhaps with this election, this, you know, plucky Malaysians have managed to get themselves out of the clutches of China, then I think that is a little bit misguided. I think ultimately, you know, Malaysia is going to deal with China. And they said so even the very day after the election. So the new government headed by Mahathir, after this campaign that pointed at China as the major threat to voters and their sovereignty, the very next day came out and said, ultimately, we don't really mind about where money comes from. We don't really mind about the national origin, and we don't really mind about the ideological origin. Ultimately, we are a trading nation. We rely on FDI, but we do want a better deal. And so I think there's going to be a fair bit of back and forth about what a better deal looks like. But I don't think that there is going to be a massive policy change. And certainly there are quizzical looks sometimes when we, you know, go to Malaysia and talk about China, you know, is there a big change, etc. Because ultimately the policy has been, you know, we're not in a position to pick a fight with any side, and we're going to keep being friends with everyone, and we're going to look in every direction. And I don't think that's going to change. But I think it's not a posture exactly. I think that's putting it too much like it's not real. I mean, but I think there is going to be a kind of a series of statements made that ultimately projects have to be in the interest of Malaysians. And a reason I say that is you probably will have noticed that before the election, the Malaysian Chinese Association, so one of the component parties of the Barisan Nasional, tried to position itself as a channel between China and Chinese investment and the Malaysian people, especially Chinese people that they're supposed to be, you know, pitching to, and they found that they were rejected. And that's partly because...
Rejected by Malaysian voters.
By voters, yeah, that's right. And I think the response has been along the lines of, you know, ultimately these projects don't bring us anything, whether we're Malay or Chinese or Indian or what. You know, ultimately the jobs are not going to be for us, and the terms are stacked against us. So I think a correcting of those terms is going to be on the government's agenda, as they've said. But Malaysia is not going to be able to change where it is, which is very much very close to China indeed.
I think the MCA actually is the only party in the world to have established a Belt and Road branch within its party organizational structure.
And Belt and Road posters.
And have photos of Xi Jinping on their campaign posters, which I think was illegal, right? Keen, you want to come in on this?
I was just going to say, Richard, I think one thing that seems clear to me, at least talking to various people, because right now the foreign minister's post is under contest within the coalition. As you know, there's no foreign minister right now, is that the discussion that seems to be going on, from what I'm told, is one, there is, take some significance, the fact that Mahathir's first foreign trip abroad is going to be to Japan, not China. And two, having the tycoon Robert Kwok as point man is significant as well, given Kwok's long-standing relationship with Xi Jinping. And his business interests in China, to somehow negotiate out of those deals that they have now. And that Mahathir himself is apparently laying down some markers for what foreign policy should be, which includes a return of some sort to the type of hedging and non-alignment that Malaysia used to be known for.
It's fascinating being in KL last week, a country without a foreign minister that doesn't seem to believe it needs one. Here we are a month on from the election, and in talking to current figures in the government as to whether or not they might be the next foreign minister, they all said, please, not me. There's not a lot of enthusiasm for taking on the foreign ministry right now. There's much more interest in posts that attract more patronage. It's a fascinating sort of dynamic. I'll take another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Liz Beock from the International Commission of Jurists. Now, the last few years have seen a real denigration of the legal system in Malaysia, with judges not being appointed, very political appointments, and cases and decisions referring to fatwa. Now, has Mahathir or anybody in the government, especially Tommy Thomas, the new Attorney General, talked about returning the Malaysian legal system to what it was in the glorious past?
James?
Oh. The short answer is that Tommy Thomas has yet to hold his first press conference. My take is that it's very, very difficult to bring the Malaysian judicial system to what it was before 1987, for very simple reason that the Islamic bureaucracy in the government is now very, very strong, And there are many layers that you've got to go through. Unless you're willing to reform the entire judicial system, it is not possible to go back.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what happened in 1987 and why the judicial system is the way that it is.
Sure. In 1987, there was a court case regarding AMNO, the ruling party then. Mahathir was the president of AMNO then, and AMNO was declared an illegal organization by the courts. And shortly after that, the judges who were involved in that court case, a few of them were removed from the bench. And ever since 1987, there's a general consensus among the legal community in Malaysia that the courts have become much more political. So the standard joke in Malaysia is that if your case is about commercial stuff, you get justice. If it is about political stuff, maybe yes, maybe no.
I'm interested because that was something that Mahathir did. Amrita or Keen, do you think that this is something... Mahathir has acknowledged that he may have made some mistakes, that he may have made the Prime Minister's office too strong. But do you think that this is one of the mistakes that he means when he talks about that?
I'd say so. I think the thing is, you know, looking at how they're restructuring the Ministry of Finance right now, how they've basically split the whole thing up and actually institutionally doing it. You know, there's this Economic Affairs Minister as well. And one aspect, actually, just as a side footnote, about Malaysian politics and how it's discussed right now is the huge boom in these encrypted WhatsApp discussion groups. And there's a lot of insight to be gleaned from that, which actually is even better than the news sites. But one thing that's going rife like wildfire right now is how the Ministry of Finance is being split up and restructured. And speaking about, you know, justice and the court system, I think there seems to be also a real desire to, you know, return to rule of law as opposed to rule by law. And that's something that I think we should take at face value, that, you know, let's see what they do. But they have made the right noises. And you have also, you know, coalition partners that are not Mahathir's party that are very keen to try and do something.
Amrita?
I just wanted to say on this this issue of Mahathir and his regrets, I think this is very interesting because I think there's a play, like a medium to long-term play, to make sure that on the one hand, the apologies that he's issued for some of the mistakes that he's made are sort of reconciled with a defense of his legacy. So as part of defending your legacy, sometimes I guess you need to apologize for the mistakes you've made. And that's why the opposition, the new government's campaign, was so much about institutional reform. So part of it was an appeal to nostalgia of don't worry, everyone, you're going to get people that you've seen before. And in fact, when we were last in power, we had this economic boom until it ended. And we had, you know, basically the glory days of Malaysian society, economy, etc. So there's a very strong desire, I think, on Mahathir's part to want to connect up with those good times, apologise for the mistakes, and then reset the nation so that, you know, the mistakes can be, I guess, set right. That doesn't mean that he's sorry about everything. It means that he's going to be sorry about enough things and change enough things that his legacy can be protected. I mean, I don't know if that's a little bit uncharitable, but that's certainly the way I'm reading the strategy and the tactics around the, on the one hand, I've made mistakes, on the other hand, I've developed this nation and I did it my way and look how far we've come. And in fact, I want to go back to those times. It's a complicated discussion, but I think that ultimately, you know, if you're 92 or 93, legacy protection is going to be part of your agenda.
I was just about to make the point that I think the right way of looking at Mahathir is that this guy has learned. In other words, the Mahathir we see today is not the Mahathir from the 1980s or 1990s. I think he is a transformed figure, and I think it's not so much a legacy. I think Mahathir, he still has the same attitude, I'm right, everybody else is wrong. He still got that attitude. But I think the big difference now is that he thought that when he left the stage in 2003, Malaysia was well on its way to become a developed country. That has, if you look from his book, from the original book, 1971, The Malay Dilemma, he always spoke about making Malaysia a fully developed country and the Malays a fully developed people. And I think that is the thing he's looking for. In other words, he's putting the foundation in place so that Malaysia can become a developed country. So I don't think he's looking back. I personally do not think he's sorry for anything that he did. Any apology he gives is mainly just to please the people around him. I still think he holds the attitude that I'm always right, you guys are wrong, but I'll play along with you because I know I've only got 2 or 3 years to set things right so that I can put the country on the right path. So I think the right way of looking at Mahathir is that he's trying to move the country or steer the ship on the path so that it will become fully developed when whoever comes after him. Because when he chose Badawi, he thought Badawi will carry on with all his mega projects, everything, so the country will be developed.
Talking about former Prime Minister Abdullah.
When he chose Badawi. And if you look at the interviews he gave, again, the interesting ones are the one he gave to Japanese newspaper. He said exactly the same thing. I thought Badawi was going to do the same thing that I was going to do. And it turned out to be a disaster. Why was he a disaster? Because he didn't follow what I said. So I think the right way to look at Mahathir is that he's completely changed. I think he's no longer the dictatorship, all that sort of thing, simply because the party is too small. He can't bully his partners anymore. But in terms of Mahathir, the person, the philosophy, still the same.
It's a beautiful sort of circular reasoning to that.
I'm Jim Dominguez. My question is of Seri Anifar, the previous foreign minister. You said that no one's putting their hands up for the job. Is that because it was too difficult, or how is he? Would he be regarded in the history books as what sort of contribution did he make, and why is there not a rush of people? Is it because Mahathir has assumed that role as foreign minister as well as prime minister?
Maybe I can just take that one. Working on Malaysian foreign policy specifically, there is a fear that Mahathir is going to run foreign policy, and that whoever his foreign minister is will just be cleaning up whatever he says, and that they won't have much policy influence. But there's also just a feeling that at this point, in such a broad coalition with so many parties and so much squabbling over who gets key roles, foreign ministry is not a very prestigious role. There's also maybe a little bit of a small country syndrome, a feeling that Malaysia isn't the big player on the world stage, despite just how much international trade it does. And the fact that, quite frankly, the bar is quite low to be a good foreign minister in Southeast Asia. Malaysia has tremendous human capital in the parliament. And if it appointed one of these more junior figures in Pakatan Harapan as foreign minister, it could actually have quite a bit of influence. But there's sort of a resistance to recognize that, a sort of sense that Malaysia is too small a country to actually influence things. So I think it is a number of factors that are combining there.
Hi, I'm Eileen Wahab from the Refugee Council of Australia. There was a considerable social justice agenda in the manifesto, reflected in the manifesto. I think the answer to my question actually has already been dealt with in the broader justice context. But what hope do you have for some of those policies which are, I suppose, a goal within the manifesto being realised? For example, they said that they would sign the Refugee Convention, that they would release children from indefinite detention.
Who wants to take that one?
I'll just address that one specifically about the Refugee Convention that I know friends of mine who work in these civil society organizations have submitted to the Institutional Reform Committee. Just briefly texting with Ambiga, who's on that, the former Bar Council chair. She was saying for them, it's a priority. It's on the table. They want to talk about it. Of course, after that, then the Attorney General and the rest of the machinery will have to get behind it.
Thank you. Patrick William. Look, the change in government is a great opportunity for a new, better reformed Malaysia, if you like. So in that context, doesn't it seem problematic, given they've appointed Tommy Thomas as Attorney General, given he is the defence attorney for Lim Guan Eng, the Minister of Finance, who's facing corruption charges? Because the only person who can drop those charges are the Attorney General.
Amrita, is that a conflict of interest?
Well, it's a tough one because he's represented a whole lot of different parties involved in Malaysian politics right now. He's represented PAS, I believe. He's represented Lim Guan Eng. He's been around. So actually, I don't even know how to answer. You know, there's just that many complicated relationships and people are popping up again after, decades. People have been around for decades. They've been involved in every possible permutation that actually I don't know how to answer.
I don't think it's even an issue because the thing is, to correct you on this, Tommy Thomas is not Guan Eng's counsel. He represented him on an issue of libel and slander against a newspaper. I think it was Utusan, one of the former government's linked newspapers. So he's not actually the defense counsel. So I don't think it's even an issue. And as we know, any of you who are lawyers, you can defend all sorts of people.
Carol Austin, I have two questions. Firstly, how far do you think the corruption inquiry will go and what will be the fallout of it? But secondly, what are the implications for the rest of the region of this dramatic change in Malaysia?
James?
Well, I think the person who will have sleepless night will be the Singaporeans. Singapore and Malaysia share fairly similar political culture, and in many ways, the brand of the PAP and the brand of UMNO, the former ruling party in Malaysia, are fairly similar. So I think if there's going to be any spillover effect, it will be felt in Singapore. In terms of the region, I think you will see the dynamics of the South China Sea crisis will be slightly different from now on. One of the things that I always tell people outside Malaysia is that the Chinese take Malaysia as the most important country in Southeast Asia, not Singapore. And the reason is a lot of people do not realize that Malaysia is the only country that covers both parts of the South China Sea. A lot of people forget that Malaysia actually has a thing called East Malaysia, Sabah, Sarawak. So if you look at the area under dispute, Malaysia is the only country that covers both sides. So if you speak to those people in Beijing, they'll tell you that Malaysia is actually a much more important country than, say, Singapore. Yes, the Chinese are trying to learn from the Singaporean system with economic reform, but no political or giving up political control. But in terms of actual geostrategic interest, Malaysia is a much more important country.
And Keane, on the corruption inquiry, will the new government just go after three key figures and call it a day, or will this be a more a deeper root and branch?
I think the
inquiry?
Groundswell for a much deeper corruption inquiry is very strong. And it's going to be very difficult for this rather fragile coalition to resist that. Not to mention the fact that I think what's interesting is that there are several, I think, leading figures within the coalition, not from Mahathir's party, but from, say, the DAP and PKR, even I can think of one or two Amanah leaders who see some of this, 20 years and counting struggle of reformasi sparked off from the mid-90s onwards, where the agenda for democratization is very deep-rooted for them. Some of them went to jail for it, as you know. And they take this very personally, that they want to advocate and fulfill what they see as having honorably promised in the manifesto. So, and many of these people also found support across the region in other civil society organizations in the Philippines, in Indonesia especially. So I think the discussion of democratization is very strong. Whether that's going to be reflected at a cabinet level, I'm not sure. But I can tell you the pressure is very strong with some cabinet ministers like Gobind Singh Deo, the multimedia communications minister, about 5-6
you
days
can
ago.
Say it, you're at the Lowy Institute.
Yeah, I'm not going to betray my sources, but the thing is, you know, I know people in his office are saying they're just getting deluged with the question of freeing up the media and how do we go about it? How do you make it possible? I mean, they are trying to deal now with governance issues, which they've never had to deal with before. As you know, with opposition, it's a lot easier.
Maybe just more broadly, Amrita, how is the new government dealing with these tremendous expectations that have been heaped upon it, like Keane just talked about?
Well, actually, I wanted to talk about something that we haven't really touched on yet, and it connects up with this issue of how do we deal with people who've popped up in every single permutation politically over the last few decades, also the 1MDB corruption inquiry, and also why on earth nobody wants to be foreign minister, and that is Anwar Ibrahim. So there's a lot of, I mean, and also this question of expectations. I mean, who is being wheeled out to deal with expectations? It is Anwar Ibrahim. So, you know, obviously he's been in prison. He's now back in kind of active public life, if not informal politics. And he's, you know, designated the prime minister in waiting, apparently. And he's been called upon to fix a few things. So he's gone out to speak to the King, for example, to talk about Tommy Thomas. He's been vocally criticising Australia for its role in, I guess, the regional sort of politics of how to deal with Malaysia. Part of what he's been saying is that Australia hasn't been, effectively, it hasn't been hedging its bets well enough in terms of who is going to be in power in Malaysia, and it's accommodated itself to Barisan Nasional being in power forever and ever, just a bit too comfortably. So he's pointing at that. He's also, I guess, pointing to the question of various other investigations that may or may not be held into Najib Razak, the former prime minister, including to do with a submarine deal and the murder of a Mongolian woman. And, you know, that the person who has been found guilty of that murder is sitting here in Villawood Detention Centre. So there's a number of regional issues that Anwar is pointing at. I don't know how comfortable that's going to be for a lot of observers, friends and allies in the region, including Australia. But I think the implications of the fact that now Najib Razak's history is going to be looked at, I think that they are manifold. There's the question of the ANZ Bank and its subsidiary that's also, you know, in some way connected with the 1MDB scandal. I think, this investigation is going to open up questions all around the region. And I think it's important that governments around the place are ready and not defensive, because they need Malaysia. As James has pointed out, Malaysia is actually very important in the region, and we all actually need it. It's a very important trading partner of Australia's. I think it's number 10 last time I checked. I can't remember anymore. It's not insignificant. So, you know, the fact that Anwar, I mean, this is also, I suppose, a small country having to accommodate a couple of big people who need to go around making points about regional politics, etc. But Anwar is out and about. He said he's going to be in Australia soon. He said that on Radio National. So let's see where it all goes. But I think the regional politics are going to get uncomfortable, but maybe they will improve as a result.
We only have a few minutes left, so I just ask James, do you have some concluding thoughts on some of the things Amrita said, or some last final points you'd like to make?
Sure, I just want to make 2 points. One is, I think we shouldn't get too excited about democracy in Malaysia or opening up Malaysia. I think you'll find that the bulk of the Malay population, they're still socially very conservative. The sort of people who are clamming for democracy, opening up system, is what I call the bangsa crowd, people who sit in Starbucks, who spend hours on Facebook, who go to WhatsApp group. Those are not the real Malaysians. Okay, so that's the first point. The second point, I think the narrative about this, the missing part about these general elections is actually what happened in East Malaysia, Sabah and Sarawak. The conditions there were totally different. One of the things that came out of Sabah, Sarawak very clearly is that these elections show very clearly that state nationalism or regional nationalism in Sabah, Sarawak is at an all-time high. In fact, I can tell you guys openly now that the Barisan coalition concept in Sabah and Sarawak has collapsed. So it doesn't exist anymore. So going forward, you will find increasingly tensions between the federal government in Putrajaya and Kuching and Kota Kinabalu in East Malaysia. And just 2 days ago, Petronas, the National Oil Corporation in Malaysia, has actually filed a suit against the Sarawak state government over who actually owns all the oil and gas thing in Malaysia. So increasingly, what is happening in East Malaysia is that people are looking back towards 1963 when Malaysia was founded and asking themselves, did we get a good deal out of Malaysia? And you all need to know, right, that Sabah and Sarawak is totally different from Malaya. Demographically, culturally, history, everything is completely different. So I think we will see ongoing tensions between Putrajaya, Kota Kinabalu and Sarawak. And I think that will be one of the new permanent features in the Malaysian politics as we go forward.
Keane, we've basically run out of time, but just a few final thoughts to sum up.
The devolution of power that James, you know, hints at, absolutely. I think that's happening, going to happen right now with some of this institutional renewal. But at the same time, I think I would be less pessimistic than James and friends like Clive Kessler, in that I think there are lots of people, even in the rural areas in the peninsula, who have a particular yearning for more democracy. They don't articulate it like that, but if you present particular options in policy terms, they will go for it. And this is, so in a way you could say democracy as an idea is up for grabs, and it's up to perhaps political leaders now to sort of articulate something that might be attractive to as broad range of people as possible.
Well, on that more hopeful note, I'm afraid we'll have to bring things to a close. Thank you so much for coming today, and please thank our panelists. And I just want to mention that on the 26th of June, we'll be having an event with Milton Osborne, a former non-resident fellow of the Lowy Institute, to launch his new book, How Pol Pot Solved the Leprosy Problem. I promise you that it will be an interesting conversation, so I encourage you all to attend then as well. Thanks very much.